Well, welcome, everybody. I'm Tom DiLorenzo, the president of the Mises Institute. And so my topic, you know, I chose the topic of the event, Our Enemy, the Bureaucracy. Sort of a, there's a famous old libertarian book, Our Enemy, the State, by Albert J. Nock. So I just used that, Our Enemy, the Bureaucracy. And the first thing I'd like to say is a few comments about bureaucracy. There's a big literature in economics on bureaucracy. Mises himself wrote a book called Bureaucracy in the 1940s, and Murray Rothbard wrote a good bit about it, and that's going to be the basis of the second part of my talk, Murray Rothbard's comments on bureaucracy. Two of my professors in graduate school 117 and a half years ago were James Buchanan and Gordon Tullock, who created the what's called the public choice school of economics. And Jim Buchanan won the Nobel Prize for this. And a big part of it, even when I was in graduate school, week after week after week, there was a seminar of somebody presenting a paper on the economics of bureaucracy. So economists have been studying this pretty seriously, not just the Austrian school, but others for quite a long time. And I'm going to just mention a few things that some of these things are obvious about bureaucracy. Some of them are not so obvious. And of course, you know, when you think about it, the difference between allocation of goods by bureaucrats and bureaucracies and the markets is couldn't be more different. We express our preferences by plunking down our money. This is what we want. And if we don't like what we get, we don't plunk it down a second time. That's, you know, money talks. But in government, government basically says to us, here, you want this. And if you don't want it, and if you don't pay for it, we will send you to prison and make you live like a dog in a cage for a couple of years. It's called going to prison for income tax evasion. And then they hire armies of propagandists to tell you how wonderful that thing is that you refuse to pay for. And that's basically how government works. We don't express our preferences for these things we want. The government tells us these are your preferences. And it couldn't be any different. And it couldn't be any more anti-consumer. And by now, you ought to know that the whole idea that we express our preferences by voting is sort of a sham, isn't it? Yeah. And the whole world wanted Joe Biden to be the dictator of the world in this election. Bureaucratic status, your status as a bureaucrat, depends on how many subordinates you have. Every question any bureaucrat who wants a bigger and better paying job is asked is, how many people work under you now? And so that creates a built-in incentives for government bureaucrats at all levels to try to use tax dollars to hire as many subordinates as possible. It's a major perk, because if you want to move up to a higher job, whether it's a bureaucrat job or a political office, you have to say, well, I've had 10,000 people under my reign in my old job, so I could easily handle 100,000. And that's one of the reasons why the bureaucracies tend to balloon. To the bureaucrat, failure is success. In the market, failure is failure. If the people don't like what you're selling, you fail. But it's failure is success. If you're working in the welfare bureaucracy and poverty goes up, we give you more money, because the answer is always, well, poverty went up because we didn't have enough money. If you're in the school bureaucracy and the test scores are going down, we give you more money. You're rewarded for failure. And on it goes. In government, failure is success. And to every government bureaucrat, failure is success. There's even a literature in economics that makes the argument that it's not universal, but a lot of like mayors and people, they make their cities get run down and go to hell because they can get more federal money by doing that. I'm not sure how pervasive that is, but it seems plausible to me that happens. In business, you take any economics class, microeconomics class, you're taught how businesses, if they want to make higher profits, they need to try to minimize their costs. And that's common sense. You don't need to take an economics class to know that if you cut your costs, then your profit margin gets bigger. That's what competition does. In government, government bureaucracies are cost maximizers, because there are no profits in an accounting sense in government. And so you can't take home, you can't get bonuses, you can't take home the profits, because there are no profits. They're just budgets. But what you can personally benefit from as a bureaucrat is perks, perquisites, bigger staff, more emoluments in your office, big travel budget, private, like the Fed has a whole core of private jets, for example, art galleries, things like that. You can spend that money. And so instead of being a profit maximizer and where you would try to minimize cost to maximize your profits, government bureaucrats try to maximize cost. They're budget maximizers. And of course, at the end of every budget year, if you do what you're supposed to do in your bureaucracy and you have money left over, you have to spend every last dime of it, even if there's only 1 month left in the budget year, because you have to make a case to some appropriation committee that you and not some other bureaucracy should be given more money next year. And so that when I lived in Northern Virginia and I taught at George Mason, I remember a series of articles in the Washington Post about how there's probably enough furniture stored in the suburbs, in the warehouses in Washington, D.C., to furnish all the rest of America. Because at the end of every budget year for generations, every bureaucracy would go on a wild spending binge and spend every last penny. Even when I was in graduate school, I was a library rat, and I basically lived in the library, and I knew the director of the library was a good friend of mine, and all the economics journals were down in the basement level. I went down there one day, and there was no room. There was furniture everywhere up to the ceiling, and you couldn't walk. I couldn't find my journals and all that. And I asked him, what the heck is going on here? And he said, well, I want to buy a new computer system for the library, and if I don't spend all the money this year, they're not going to give me the money for the new computer system. And so I just bought every staff member, like two complete sets of furniture for every member of the staff. And that happens all the time. Now, this kind of stuff happens in the private sector, of course, but then there's a cost, and that, you know, your return of investment goes down, your profitability goes down, and it could reflect on you poorly, and it will if you do that. Bureaucrats play the Washington Monument Syndrome. This is named after the director of the National Park Service when he didn't get the budget he wanted from Congress, so he shut down the Washington Monument, the most popular tourist attraction in Washington, D.C., and tourists from every state called their members of Congress to complain about it, and Congress turned around and gave him his budget. And so this was in the 1960s this happened. And so that game is played by government at all levels of sort of an extortion racket. You know, we're going to cut all the school buses for the kids, so you're going to have to take the kids to school or make them walk if you don't raise the tax, vote in favor of the tax that we want, you know, to raise for the schools and that sort of thing. One final thing that I'll mention is there's a libertarian class analysis, and it's not like Marxian class struggle analysis between the capitalist class and the working class. And this goes back hundreds of years, and one American political philosopher who's associated with this is John C. Calhoun, a former vice president, senator from South Carolina. He wrote a great book called A Disquisition on Government. He was one of Murray Rothbard's favorite American political philosophers, if not his very favorite. Murray quoted him over and over again in a lot of his writings. And one of the things he was known for is he articulated what we call the libertarian class analysis, where the two classes are taxpayers on the one hand versus tax consumers on the other hand. Taxpayers pay more in tax than they get in benefits from government. Tax consumers are people who get more benefits from government than they pay in taxes. And of course, the bureaucracy is the major component of the tax consumers. Okay. And Calhoun wrote about how there's inherently a conflict, obviously, between the tax consumers and the taxpayers. And he predicted that the tax consumers would inevitably prevail regardless of whatever the Constitution said about placing limits on government. That's why Calhoun was in favor of some sort of system where the people of the states could nullify federal laws that they thought were unconstitutional, because he thought a written constitution would never be enough to stop the overwhelming of the taxpayers by the tax consumers. And now that we have a giant welfare state, that's even more true. For example, today, The adjusted gross income, family income, over $100,000, people in that category pay 87% of all the federal income tax. And that's not a huge fortune. The top 50% of American taxpayers in terms of income level pay 98% of all income taxes. And so we've got a huge division between the taxpayers, a relatively small group, and the tax consumers just on that basis. And the bureaucracy is a big part of that. And I guess the real final comment I make about the essence of bureaucracy is that the bureaucrats don't do this alone. They always have to hire an army of intellectuals to create rationales for why what they do is absolutely necessary, and they can never do without a single one penny less. Anytime anybody proposes in Congress to cut taxes, there is immediately a response saying, how will we make up the revenue? You know, as though, you know, the government can never have $1 less. During the COVID tyranny, I bet not one government bureaucrat lost a penny in pay in America at federal, state, and local levels. And they got, in fact, they had paid vacations. It's even better yet. They have full pay and you go home and play golf, you know, and get paid anyway. That's what they did. But of course, thousands of businesses were destroyed and America's lives were made miserable for quite a long time for all that. So that's sort of my opening comments about the essence of bureaucracy. And so in the rest of my time, what I'd like to introduce you to is one of Murray Rothbard's essays is entitled Bureaucracy and the Civil Service in the United States. And here's one of the things he says about this. And this is a quote, "No system has been more savagely derided by establishment do-gooders than the spoils system." Now, you probably heard this phrase, the spoils system. It's when, you know, a new party is elected, president, and they appoint all of their people, their party members, to all these government jobs. Somebody asked me this morning, am I going to talk about Lincoln? And so this is my entree to talk about Lincoln, because he was by up to his time, he was by far the biggest practitioner of the spoils system. Even a lot of his generals were political generals who had no experience in the military, but it was just a reward for political support as far as that goes. And Lincoln, by the way, you know, since I've written several books on this, as a young man, he said his life's ambition was to be the DeWitt Clinton of Illinois. DeWitt Clinton was the former governor of New York who specialized in the spoils system, who became very powerful politically with the spoils system. And so, you know, if you read the history books and you read about this aspect of Lincoln, that's what it's about. And then here's something else, another quote by Rothbard on the spoils system. No measure of government has been more destructive of liberty and minimal government than civil service reform. What? Nothing. This is Murray Rothbard, the great Murray Rothbard, Mr. Libertarian. He's saying nothing he can think of is more destructive of liberty and minimal government than civil service reform. That is the reform that got rid of the spoils system, you know, and so that the civil servants, as they call themselves, they take a test. And so we hire only the best and brightest bureaucrats now. We don't just hire some guy who's, you know, he went out and rounded up a bunch of votes for the candidate. It's they're professionals now. Okay. And here's what he means by this, is one of the things Murray means by this. The never-ending expansion of bureaucracy. With the spoils system, say you had 10,000 bureaucrats in the federal government back in the day, back in the 19th century. New party is elected, a different party is elected president. It was typical that all 10,000 would be fired, and then that new party would replace them all with members of his party. But with civil service reform, it made it almost impossible to fire a bureaucrat. In today's world, the head of some government agency, despite what Elon Musk is doing, he's having some success, and this is sort of different. But for generations, what has been true is that if you're the head of an agency and you want to fire somebody, you can bet your life you're going to be sued by the union, by the public employees union, and you're going to be in legal hell as your day-to-day job for a year or longer over this nitwit that you want to get rid of. So it's much easier if you want to get rid of that person from your workplace, offer him or her a promotion, you know, bribe them to get lost, because it's going to cost you a lot in misery, a lot of stress, you know, and everything, and a lot of diversion of your attention away from your golf game to deal with all these lawyers from the government unions. And so that's what's happened. Okay. And so, but now with the civil service system, the new party comes in and you got your 10,000 bureaucrats, you can no longer fire them with the civil service. So what do? You hire 10,000 more of your people. Okay. And then you lose the next election in 4 years. And the same thing happens. The new person, they can't fire your 10,000 employees either, your patronage employees. So they hire 10 or 20,000 more of their own. And on it goes, you know, generation after generation. And so you got this snowballing effect of bureaucracy. And this is how we became a centrally planned society. You know, every aspect of our life is affected in some way. I think John Stossel, who made a lot of videos that I show in my classrooms, and one of them is a very memorable scene where he has a family asleep in their beds and the alarm clock rings, and he goes through, he counts down how many taxes are imposed on every single thing, the alarm clock itself, the water bill, the pillow has a warning label from OSHA on the pillow. It's just every step in the beginning of your day, every day, is affected by some government bureaucracy somewhere. It wasn't always like that. It wasn't always like that. Okay, so that's what Murray is talking about. And so civil service reform essentially created lifetime tenure for the vast majority of bureaucracies. Okay. And in my opinion, the federal judiciary is probably the worst of all these bureaucracies, because they really have lifetime tenure. Andrew Jackson, when Andrew Jackson was president, we still had the spoils system. And he condemned the idea of what he called a property right in a government job. And he fired 41% of all federal bureaucrats. You can applaud if you want. Andrew Jackson. And Jackson, by the way, was one of Murray Rothbard's favorites. You know, he wasn't a saint. He wasn't the perfect libertarian god. You know, when I say this, I'll probably get email from the libertarian purists out there that say, well, what about the Indians? Or what? You know, of course, he was a human being. He did a lot of bad things as well. But this was a good thing that he did. President John Tyler. Who's ever heard of President John Tyler? You have about maybe two or three people in the whole. There's a book called Recarving Rushmore by Ivan Eland, published by the Independent Institute in California. And he ranks all the presidents according to how good a job they did in protecting life, liberty, and property. Okay. Lincoln is way down there near the bottom. Number one is John Tyler. Became president in 1841. My favorite president, William Henry Harrison, died after 1 month in office. And Tyler was the vice president, and he took over. And he vetoed everything. He vetoed the tariffs. He vetoed a national bank. He vetoed corporate welfare for the railroad corporations and other road building companies and all that. And so he was a pretty good guy. And he fired 50% of all federal bureaucrats. So he did even better than Andrew Jackson. Yeah, this is 1841. So in comparison, what Elon Musk is doing is nothing. It's trivial. Yeah, the big media, you know, the Trump himself makes all these speeches, has Elon Musk and one of his 19 children next to him on his lap and announcing what a great job he's doing. But compared to Andrew Jackson and John Tyler, it's really peanuts, not much. The reform, who were these reformers? This all happened in the late 19th century. And this is pretty interesting, what Murray says about these people, Murray Rothbard. So they're almost exclusively New England, from New England and New York, highly educated, and quote, shaped by the cultural and religious values of their neo-Puritan Yankee culture, end quote. That's Murray Rothbard saying. They wanted only good men in public office, the good men being themselves. They believed they had an inherent right of their sort to rule over lesser citizens. That's Murray Rothbard saying that, to rule over the rest of us. They professed a belief in democracy, but only if guided by people like themselves. Otherwise, democracy is shamocracy. They don't care about that. And when I reread this statement by Murray Rothbard, it reminded me of something Clyde Wilson wrote. He wrote a whole book called The Yankee Problem in America, Clyde Wilson. And he says this on the Yankee. He says, by Yankee, I do not mean everybody from the north of the Potomac in Ohio. Lots of them have always been good folks. I'm using the term historically to designate that peculiar group descended from New Englanders who can be easily recognized by their arrogance, hypocrisy, greed, lack of congeniality, and penchant for ordering other people around. Then he says, Hillary Rodham Clinton is a museum-quality specimen of a Yankee. The self-righteous, ruthless, and self-aggrandizing. The Yankee temperament, it should be noted, makes a neat fit with the Stalinism that was brought to the deep north by later immigrants, meaning New England, New York, Upper Midwest, the University of Wisconsin, all these places where you had communism, basically. It was very popular for many years. And so that's how Murray described the people who brought on civil service reform and the bureaucratization of American society. This began during the Grant administration, but Grant wasn't for it. He wasn't for it. President James Garfield, later on, was assassinated, and the Republicans blamed the person who shot him. They claimed he was, quote, a disappointed office seeker, which was a total lie, and they knew it was a total lie. So what they were saying is, well, this guy didn't get a government job because of the spoils system, so we got to get rid of that, and we need civil service reform, or else they're gonna kill more presidents if this doesn't happen. Here's what Murray Rothbard says about this argument. He said, the idea that murder by an office seeker can only be combated by abolishing offices to be sought is even sillier than the comparable argument that the way to eliminate assault or murder in general is to outlaw guns. That's what Murray Rothbard was saying. But that was the argument that was made. And I guess enough people that H.L. Mencken once called Bubus Americanus bought it. It went for it and supported it. President Chester Arthur signed the Pendleton Act on January 16th, 1883, and that established the little civil service system. It got rid of the spoils system. And it was really a last-ditch attempt. They knew that Grover Cleveland was going to be elected president. He was a Democrat. He was very popular. And they knew he was going to win. And so they wanted to minimize the damage of Grover Cleveland coming in. And I once wrote an article about Grover Cleveland once called The Last Good Democrat. And he really was sort of the last Jeffersonian president we ever had. But anyway, they wanted to do something to counter that, and they thought cementing in place Republican Party bureaucrats would be a good idea. And so he signed the Pendleton Act. In my own notes here, I wrote, thus the deep state was created. What is the deep state if it's not the permanent Washington, D.C. bureaucracy? We hear a lot about it being part of the military bureaucracy, which is true. But that's only just a part of it. The so-called, I always laugh when I hear people call it the intelligence community. One of my friends when I lived in South Carolina was a retired F-18 pilot, and I always used to tell him that my favorite oxymoron is military intelligence, and the intelligence community. Yeah. But that's a part of the deep state. So the end result of this, Murray says, is this, the ideals of merit and a technocratic elite, that's what they sold the civil service reform on, was employed in the service of big government, protectionism, inflationary bank credit, and imperialism in foreign war. That's what we got from civil service reform and the abandonment of the spoil system. And so what that means is that Elon Musk better get off his butt and fire a few million more government bureaucrats. And so, and that's my story for today, and I'm sticking to it.